of a specific, innovative, and highly successful initial product or service, what you might call a great idea. In contrast, we trace the founding roots of 11 comparison companies much closer to the great idea model. In other words, we found that the visionary companies were much less likely to begin life with a great idea than the comparison companies in our research. Furthermore, whatever the initial founding concept, we found that the visionary companies were in fact less likely to have early entrepreneurial success than the comparison companies. In only 3 of 18 pairs did the visionary company have greater initial success than the comparison company, whereas in 10 cases, the comparison company, the company that didn't become the iconic great company in the end, had greater initial success than the visionary company. And 5 of our cases were indistinguishable. Here's the key point. We found a negative correlation between early entrepreneurial success and becoming a highly visionary company. The race goes to the tortoise, not the hare. So right off the bat, we had to reject the great idea or brilliant strategy explanation of corporate success, and we had to consider a new view. We had to put on a different lens and look at the world backward. We had to shift from seeing the company as a vehicle for the products to seeing the products as a vehicle for the company. Now let's just go back to the HP case here. Think about this. When HP founded its company, it wasn't to bring a product to the world. It wasn't, we have this great idea, and now let's build a company and bring that idea to the world. It was the opposite. It was, let's start a company, and now we've got to come up with some products to bring the company to the world. See, that's how people who build great companies think. We're building a great company, now we need some products, rather than we're building a great product, and now we need a company. This led us to this insight of the difference between time telling and clock building. Now, to grasp the difference between clock building and time telling, compare GE, or General Electric, and Westinghouse in their early days. GE is the visionary company. Westinghouse is the comparison company. George Westinghouse, he was a brilliant product visionary, a prolific inventor who founded 59 other companies besides Westinghouse. Additionally, Westinghouse had the insight that the world should favor the AC electrical system over Edison's DC system. And in fact, he was right. The AC system won. But now compare George Westinghouse to Charles Coffin, my personal pick for the number one chief executive officer of the entire 20th century, GE's president, installed shortly after the founding of the company. Now think about this. Most people have never even heard of Charles Coffin. And that's the ultimate testimony to his greatness. Coffin's predecessor had something to do with this. No CEO finds it easy to take over from a founding entrepreneur. But now imagine that that founder holds patents on the electric light, the phonograph, the motion picture, the alkaline battery, and the dissemination of electricity. But Coffin knew his job was not to be the next Thomas Edison, though Coffin, too, would prove a master inventor. His invention was not the light bulb. It was something even more significant. It was the General Electric Company. And Coffin oversaw 2 social innovations of huge significance: America's first research laboratory in an industrial setting, and the idea of systematic management development. While George Westinghouse was a great time teller, a towering genius around whom the whole system revolved, Charles Coffin created a system of genius that did not depend upon him. Like the founders of the United States, he created the ideology and the mechanisms that made his institution one of the most enduring and widely emulated institutions in the world. George Westinghouse's greatest creation, the AC power system, Charles Coffin's greatest creation, the General Electric Company. Luck favors the persistent. This simple truth is a fundamental cornerstone of successful company builders. The builders of visionary companies were highly persistent, living to the motto, never, 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 never give up. But what to persist with? Their answer the company. Be prepared to kill, revise, or evolve an idea, but never give up on the company. Be prepared to move away from the original DC system of electricity dissemination and embrace the AC system. Change the idea, change the business concept, but never, ever give up on the company. Clock building, not time telling. If you equate the success of your company with the success of a specific idea, as many business people do, then you're more likely to give up on the company if that idea fails. And if that idea happens to succeed, you're more likely to have an emotional love affair with that idea and stick with it too long when the company should be moving vigorously on to other things. We're going to come to this a bit later when we talk about Henry Ford and how Henry Ford fell in love with the Model T, the black Model T. Remember when he said, "They can have any color as long as it's black"? He wouldn't change because he loved his product too much. And that was one of the things that made Ford's eventual transition to a visionary company more difficult. But you see, if you envision that the ultimate creation, your ultimate creation, is the organization, is the company, is the institution, not the execution of a specific idea or capitalizing on a specific opportunity, then you can persist beyond any specific idea, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, and move towards becoming an enduring great institution. In 1973, an interviewer asked David Packard what specific product decisions he considered the most important in the company's growth. Now, you might think that Packard would respond in terms of the calculator or the computer or some of the instruments that they built, but no, he didn't include one single product in his answer. He answered entirely in terms of organizational decisions. Developing an engineering team, a pay-as-you-go policy to impose fiscal discipline, a profit-sharing program, personnel and management policies, the HP Way philosophy of management, and so on. It perfectly illustrates that Bill Hewlett and David Packard's ultimate creation was not the audio oscilloscope or the pocket calculator. It was the Hewlett-Packard Company and the HP Way of managing. Masaru Obuka's greatest product was not the Walkman or the Trinitron. It was Sony, the company, and what it stands for. Walt Disney's greatest creation was not Fantasia or Snow White or even Disneyland. It was the Walt Disney Company and its uncanny ability to make people happy. We don't mean to imply that the visionary companies never had superb products or good ideas. They certainly did. And as we'll discuss later in the book, most of them view their products and services as making useful and important contributions to customers' lives. But we suggest that the continual stream of great products and services from the highly visionary companies stems from them being outstanding organizations. And this is the key point. Now I want to come to a second myth about success and companies and entrepreneurs, and that's the myth of the great and charismatic leader. When Jerry and I would ask executives and business students to speculate about the distinguishing variables, the root causes, and the success of the visionary companies, they frequently mention, well, it must be great leadership. And they point to George Merck and Sam Walton and Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard and Charles Coffin and Walt Disney and J. Willard Marriott and Thomas J. Watson and John Nordstrom. They argue that these chief executives displayed high levels of persistence. They overcame significant obstacles. They attracted dedicated people to the organization. They influenced groups of people towards the achievement of goals, and they played key roles in guiding their companies through crucial episodes in their history. All this is true, but, and this is the crucial point, so did their counterparts at the comparison companies. The comparison founding leaders also displayed high levels of persistence. They also overcame significant obstacles. They also attracted dedicated people to the organization. They also influenced groups of people towards the achievement of goals. And they also played key roles in guiding their companies through crucial episodes in their history. We found such leaders in both sets of companies. It cannot explain the difference between the two. It simply cannot. We found no evidence to support the hypothesis that charismatic leadership, the towering hero, is the distinguishing variable during the critical formative stages of the visionary companies. In fact, if you look closely, we found that some of the most significant chief executives in the history of the visionary companies did not have the personality traits of a high-profile, charismatic, visionary leader. Some even had what you might say is a charisma bypass. Let's look at William McKnight. Do you know who William McKnight is? Does he stand out in your mind as one of the great business leaders of the 20th century? Can you describe his leadership style? Have you read his biography? If you're like most people, you know little or nothing about William McKnight. As of 1993, when we were studying McKnight, he had not made it onto Fortune magazine's National Business Hall of Fame. Few articles had ever been written about him. His name doesn't appear in the Hoover's Handbook sketch of the company's history. When we started our research, we were embarrassed to say that we didn't even recognize his name. Yet the company that McKnight guided for 52 years earned fame and admiration around the world. It carries the revered name Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, or as we all know it, 3M for short. 3M is famous. William McKnight is not. And we suspect he would have wanted it exactly that way. McKnight began work in 1907 as a simple assistant bookkeeper and rose to cost accountant. Now there's an exciting place to find CEOs in cost accounting. And then eventually a sales manager before becoming general manager. We could find no evidence that he had a highly charismatic leadership style. Of the nearly 50 references to McKnight in the company's self-published history, only one refers to his personality, and that described him as a soft-spoken, gentle man. His biographer described him as a good listener, humble, modest, slightly stooped, unobtrusive, and soft-spoken, quiet, thoughtful, and serious. McKnight is not the only significant chief executive in the history of the visionary companies that breaks the model of the charismatic visionary leader. Ibuka of Sony had a reputation as being reserved, thoughtful, and introspective. Bill Hewlett, when we did our interview with him, he reminded us of a friendly, no-nonsense, matter-of-fact, down-to-earth farmer from Iowa who had likely gotten lost looking for a place to go fishing. Bill Allen, the most significant CEO in Boeing's history, and my own pick, looking back across all of my research, as the number two most significant chief executive officer of the entire 20th century, was a pragmatic lawyer. He was, as they said, rather benign in appearance, and a rather shy and infrequent smile. George W. Merck built the powerhouse Merck & Company, was the embodiment of Merck restraint. He was German. We're not claiming that the visionary companies had poor leadership. Quite the contrary. We're simply pointing out that excellent leadership and personal charisma are not one and the same. In fact, as we're going to talk about in a later chapter, we found that the visionary companies did a better job than the comparison companies at developing and promoting leadership talent from inside the company, and thereby they attained greater continuity of excellence at the top through multiple generations. But just like we talked about with products, the continuity of superb individuals atop the visionary companies stems from them being outstanding organizations, not the other way around. In other words, once you've built a great system generates great leaders. Let's return to GE to illustrate this point. Consider Jack Welch, the high-profile CEO at GE in the 1980s and 1990s. Now, we can't deny that Welch played a huge role in revitalizing GE, or that he brought an immense energy, drive, and magnetic personality with him into the CEO's office. But obsessing on Welch's leadership style diverts us from a central point. Welch grew up in GE. He didn't hold a job anywhere else in his life other than GE. He was a product of GE as much as the other way around. Somehow GE, the organization, had the ability to attract, retain, develop, groom, and select Welch, the leader. GE was a great company long before Jack Welch, and will be a great company, in all likelihood, long after Jack Welch. And as we'll discuss in Chapter 8, Welch was not the first truly great CEO in GE's history. He's had basically 100 years of them. He came from a long line of true leadership, and he's not going to be the last. GE will likely have another 100 years of exceptional leadership. As in the case of Charles Coffin versus George Westinghouse, we did see differences between the two groups of early shapers, but the differences were more subtle than great leader versus not great leader. The key difference is a shift in perspective and orientation. The evidence suggests that the key people at formative stages of the visionary companies had a stronger orientation to building the organization than the leaders in the comparison companies. Didn't matter whether they were charismatic or not. What mattered is, are you a clock builder or a time teller? Without question, some of the great CEOs in our study did have high levels of personal charisma, such as Walt Disney and Jack Welch, but many did not. Furthermore, a number of the comparison leaders also had high levels of personal charisma, and keep in mind, they failed to build enduring great companies. Having personal charisma is about as relevant to building an enduring great company as whether you have blue eyes or blonde hair. It is simply a personality characteristic, not a definition of leadership. Charisma is not a definition of leadership. As the study progressed, in fact, we became increasingly uncomfortable with the term leader at all and began to embrace the term architect, or, as we've said earlier, clock builder. And a second key difference really relates to the type of clock that these people built, and that's really the subject of the rest of this book. Now, I'd like to highlight for you a few further contrasts to illustrate this whole clock building approach. One of my favorites is the contrast between Walmart and Ames department stores. No doubt Sam Walton had the personality characteristics of a flamboyant, charismatic leader. You just can't help but think of his shimmy-shaking down Wall Street in a grass skirt, yes, he really did that, and flower lays, backed by a band of hula dancers. He did this in order to fulfill a promise to employees for breaking 8% profit. He said, you break 8% profit, I'll go to Wall Street in a grass skirt and shimmy shake. And he did. And you cannot help but think of him leaping up on store counters and leading hundreds of screaming employees through a rousing rendition of the Walmart cheer. Yes, Walton had a unique and powerful personality. But here's a key point. So did thousands of other people who didn't build Walmart. The key difference between Sam Walton and the leaders at Ames is not that he was a more charismatic leader, but that he was much more of a clock builder, an architect. By his early 20s, Walton had pretty much settled upon his personality style. He spent the bulk of his life in a never-ending quest to build and develop the capabilities of the Walmart organization, not to further develop his personal charisma. This was true even in Walton's own eyes. Again, we go back to his really wonderful book that I warmly recommend, Made in America. Sam wrote, "What nobody realized, including a few of my own store managers at the time, was that we were really trying from the beginning to become the very best operators, the most professional managers that we could. There's no question I have the personality of a promoter. But underneath that personality, I have always had the soul of an operator, somebody who wants to make things work well, then better, then the best they possibly can. I was never in anything for the short haul. I always wanted to build as fine a retailing organization as I could." In 1985, stock analyst A.G. Edwards described the ticking clock that Sam Walton had built. Personnel operate in an environment where change is encouraged. For example, if a store associate makes suggestion regarding merchandising, cost savings, ideas, whatever, these ideas are quickly disseminated. Multiply each suggestion by over 750 stores and by over 80,000 employees. And this leads to substantial sales gains, cost reductions, and improved productivity. See, whereas Sam Walton concentrated on creating an organization that would evolve and change on its own, independent of him, the leaders over at Ames dictated all changes from above, and detailed in a book the precise steps a store manager should take, leaving no room whatsoever for initiative. Whereas Walton groomed a capable successor to take over the company after his death, Mr. David Glass, who, by the way, was not known as a highly charismatic leader, the Gilmans, over at Ames Department Stores, had no such person in place, and they left the company to outsiders who did not share their philosophy. In a sad note, a 1990 Forbes article on Ames noted, co-founder Herbert Gilman has seen his creation destroyed. On a happier note, Sam Walton died with his creation intact and the belief that it could prosper long beyond him, even stronger than with himself at the helm. He knew that he would probably not live to the year 2000. Yet shortly before he died in 1992, he set audacious goals for the company out to the year 2000, displaying a deep confidence in what the company could achieve independent of his presence. Another interesting contrast is Motorola versus Zenith in their early days. Motorola's founder, Paul Galvin, dreamed first and foremost about building a great and lasting company. Galvin, architect of one of the most successful technology companies in the early part of the 20th century, did not have an engineering background, but he did hire excellent engineers. He encouraged dissent, discussion, and disagreement, and he gave individuals the latitude to show what they could do largely on their own. He set challenges and gave people immense responsibilities so as to stimulate the organization and its people to grow and learn, sometimes by failures and mistakes. Galvin's biographer summarized, he was not an inventor, but a builder whose blueprints were people. According to his son, Robert Galvin, "My father urged us to reach out to people, to all the people, for their leadership contribution. Yes, their creative leadership contribution." Early on, he was obsessed with management succession. Ironically, he did not fear his own demise. His concern was for the company. Now let's compare Paul Galvin to Zenith's founder, Commander. Yes, he went by the name Commander. Commander Eugene F. McDonald Jr. He had no succession plan, thus leaving a void of talent at the top after his unexpected death in 1958. McDonald was a tremendously charismatic leader who moved the company forward primarily through the sheer force of his gigantic personality. He was described as the volatile, opinionated mastermind of Zenith. McDonald had, quote, colossal self-assurance, based on a very high opinion of his own judgment. He expected all, except his closest friends, to address him as Commander. A brilliant tinkerer and experimenter who pushed many of his own inventions and ideas, he had a rigid attitude that almost caused Zenith to miss out on television. A history of Zenith states, "McDonald's flamboyant style was echoed in the company's dramatic advertising methods, and this style, coupled with the innovative genius and inability to sense changes in public tastes, meant that for more than 3 decades in the public perception, McDonald was Zenith." 2.5 years after McDonald's death, Fortune magazine commented, "Zenith is still growing and reaping profits from the drive and imagination of its late founder. McDonald's powerful personality remains a palpable influence on the company. But the company's future now depends on its ability and new drive to meet conditions McDonald never anticipated." A competitor commented, "As time goes on, Zenith will miss McDonald more and more." Galvin and McDonald died within 18 months of each other. Motorola, after that, sailed successfully into new arenas never dreamed of by Paul Galvin. Zenith languished, and as of 1993, when we were doing this research, it had never regained the energy and innovative spark that it had during McDonald's lifetime. Two founders, two very different approaches, two very different outcomes in the generation after. Now, the last contrast that we'd like to give you in this chapter to illustrate clock building and time telling is Walt Disney versus Columbia Pictures. Now, quick, stop and think. Disney. What comes to mind? Can you create a set of images that you associate with Disney? now. Quick, stop and think. Columbia Pictures. Can you do the same thing? Anything come to mind? If you're like most people, you can quickly conjure up images of Disney, what it means, but you probably had a bit of trouble with Columbia Pictures. In the case of Walt Disney, no question that Walt himself brought immense personal imagination and personal talent, personal genius, if you will, to building Disney. He originated many of Disney's early ideas. And by any measure, he was a superb time teller. But even so, in comparison to his comparison founder, Harry Cohn, over at Columbia Pictures, Walt was in fact much more of a clock builder. Cohn, quote, cultivated his image as a tyrant, keeping a writing whip, yes, he kept a writing whip, near his desk, occasionally cracking it for emphasis. And Columbia had the greatest creative turnover of any major studio due largely to Cohn's methods. An observer of his funeral in 1958 commented that the 1,300 attendees had not come to bid farewell, but to make sure that he was actually dead. We didn't find as much information on Cohn as we did on Walt Disney, but what evidence we did find suggested that Cohn cared primarily about being a movie mogul and about having immense personal power in Hollywood. In fact, he was the first person in Hollywood, according to our records, to assume the titles of president and producer. And he cared not so much about the qualities of his company that might endure beyond him, but more about himself, his own power, his own influence, about Cohn the great man. Now, this personal purpose propelled Columbia Pictures forward for years. But such personal and egocentric ideology could not possibly guide and inspire a company after his death. Upon his death, the company fell into listless disarray, and it had to be rescued in 1973, eventually sold to Coca-Cola. Walt Disney, on the other hand, well, Walt spent the day before he died in a hospital bed, thinking out loud about how to best develop Disney World in Florida. Walt would die, but Disney's ability to make people happy, to bring joy to children, to create laughter and tears, that would not die. Walt was more of a clock builder. There are a number of messages here for CEOs, for managers, for entrepreneurs, for people in all different kinds of walks of life. And they come in different packages. For example, I've had students come to me and say, Jim, I really want to start my own company, but I don't have a great idea. And of course, now what I do is I want to reach across the desk and hug them because I want to say, that's great. You're just like Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. Maybe you'll start the next HP. That's great. You're just a little bit like the folks at Sony. Maybe your company will become Sony. Because it turns out that starting a company with a great idea, based on our research, might turn out to be a pretty bad idea. In fact, you might think about it this way. Maybe the crucial question to think about is not what product idea to start your company with, but rather, who do you want to be in business with? Who do you want to start an organization with? Not what, but who. Thinking about who is clock building. Thinking about what is time telling. And one of the most important steps you can take in building a visionary company is really not an action. It's a whole shift in perspective. There are going to be lots of action-oriented findings in the chapters that follow, but to make good use of them requires first and foremost acquiring the right frame of mind. Think about it this way. Prior to the Newtonian Revolution, people explained the world around them primarily in terms of God. And I'm not saying this is an atheist or non-atheist perspective, but prior to science coming in and being able to explain how the universe worked, if a child broke his arm, people would say, God did it. If crops failed, they would say, God did it. People thought that everything could be explained by a simple, direct, one all-knowing that stepped in and made it happen. But then in the 1600s, people said, no, that's not it. What God did was to put in place a universe with certain principles. And what we need to do is to figure out how those principles work. We need to understand physics and geophysics and biology and chemistry, so that we can understand the processes that God put in place. And from that point on, people began to look for the basic underlying dynamics and principles of the entire system. And that's what that whole Newtonian revolution was all about. And we're asking you to see the success of truly great companies as coming from underlying processes and fundamental dynamics embedded in the organization, not the result of single great ideas or single all-knowing individual visionaries. If you're involved in building or managing an organization of any kind, doesn't even have to be a business, we're asking you to think less in terms of being a brilliant visionary, a brilliant time teller, and thinking more in terms of being an organizational visionary and in building the characteristics of a visionary company. To use one of my favorite analogies, we're asking you to consider a shift in thinking that's in fact analogous to the shift required to found the United States in the 1700s. Prior to the dramatic revolutions in political thought of the 17th and 18th centuries, the prosperity of a European kingdom or country depended in large part on the quality of the king. If you had a good king or a good queen, then you had a good kingdom. If the king was a great and wise leader, then the kingdom might prosper as a result. But now compare the good king view of the world with the approach taken at the founding of the United States. The critical question at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was not, who should be president? Who should lead us? Who is the wisest among us? Who would be the best king? No, in fact, it was just the opposite. The founders of the country concentrated on such questions as, what processes can we create that will give us good presidents long after we're dead and gone? What type of enduring country do we want to build? On what principles? On what mechanisms? On what devices? How should it operate? And that's when they wrote the Constitution. Think of it as that the Declaration of Independence set forth the values, but the Constitution became the mechanisms in the ticking clock. What the Constitutional Convention was clock building in its consummate form. And that is the genius of the founders of the United States of America. Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and John Adams were not charismatic visionary leaders in the it all depends upon me mode. No, they were organizational visionaries. They created a constitution to which they and all future leaders would be subservient. They focused on building a country. They rejected the good king model. They were clock builders. But notice something. In the case of the United States, it's not a cold, mechanistic, Newtonian, or Darwinian clock. It is a clock based on human ideals and values. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It is a clock built on human needs and aspirations. It is a clock with a spirit. And that brings us to the second pillar of our findings. It's not just building any random clock. It's building a particular type of clock. Although the shapes and sizes and mechanisms, styles, ages, and other attributes of the ticking clocks vary across the visionary companies, we found that they share an underlying set of fundamental dynamics. In the chapters that follow, we will describe these characteristics. The important thing for you to keep in mind is that once you make that shift from time-telling to clock-building, most of what's required to build a visionary company can be learned. Yes, it can be learned. You don't have to sit around waiting until you're lucky enough to have a great idea. You don't have to accept the false view that until your company has a charismatic visionary leader, it can't become a visionary company. There is no mysterious quality or elusive magic. Indeed, once you learn the essentials, you and all those around you can just get down to the hard work of making your company great. Now, before we head into the inner workings of an enduring great company, before we bore more deeply into the clock, we need to introduce one important idea, what we came to call the genius of the and. F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." This is exactly what the visionary companies are able to do. Visionary companies do not oppress themselves with what we call the tyranny of the or, O-R, which pushes people to believe that things must be either A or B, but not both. Instead of being oppressed by the tyranny of the or, highly visionary companies liberate themselves with the genius of the and, the ability to embrace both extremes of a number of dimensions at the same time. Instead of choosing between A or B, they figure out a way to create both A and B. For example, On the one hand, they have purpose beyond profit. And yet, on the other hand, they have pragmatic pursuit of profit. On the one hand, you have a relatively fixed ideology, set of values. And yet, at the same time, on the other hand, vigorous change and movement. On the one hand, conservatism around those core values. And yet, on the other hand, bold, committing, risky moves. They have, on the one hand, clear vision and a sense of direction. And yet, at the same time, on the other hand, opportunistic groping and experimentation. On the one hand, they set big, hairy, audacious goals. And yet, on the other hand, they pursue incremental, evolutionary progress. On the one hand, they select managers largely from within. And yet, at the same time, those very same inside managers induce change from within. They have, on the one hand, tight, almost cult-like cultures. And yet, on the other hand, while these cultures are tight, they have the ability to change and move and adapt. They invest for the long term and have demands for short-term performance. They are philosophical, visionary, futuristic, and they have superb daily execution. They get the nuts and bolts right. They are aligned with their core values, and they are aligned to be adaptable to the surrounding environment. A whole series of and, genius of and, characterizes the truly great institutions. And we're not talking about mere balance here. We're not talking about just kind of going into the middle of 50-50, half and half, sort of this gray zone of nothing that is really clear. Rather, a company doesn't seek a balance between short-term and long-term. It seeks to do very well in the short-term and very well in the long-term. It doesn't simply balance between idealism and profitability. It seeks to be highly idealistic and highly profitable. A visionary company doesn't simply balance between preserving tightly held core values and stimulating vigorous change. It does both to an extreme. In short, a highly visionary company doesn't want to blend yin and yang into a gray, indistinguishable circle that is neither highly yin nor highly yang. It aims to be distinctly yin and distinctly yang, both at the same time, all the time.
Chapter 3. More Than Profits. When Merck & Company reached its 100th birthday, it published a book entitled Values and Visions, A Merck Century. Notice something? The title doesn't even mention what Merck does. Merck could have titled the book From Chemicals to Pharmaceuticals, A Merck Century, or 100 Years of Financial Success at Merck. But it didn't. It chose instead to emphasize that it has been throughout its history a company guided and inspired by a set of ideals. In 1935, decades before value statements became popular, George Merck II articulated those ideals when he said, "We are workers in industry who are genuinely inspired by the ideals of advancement of medical science and of service to humanity." In 1991, 56 years and three full generations of leadership later, Merck's chief executive, P. Roy Vagelis, sang the same idealistic tune. "Above all, let's remember that our business success means victory against disease and help to humankind." With these ideals as a backdrop, we're not surprised that Merck elected to develop and give away Mectizan, a drug to cure river blindness, a disease that infected over 1 million people in the Third World with parasitic worms that swarmed through body tissue and eventually into the eyes, causing blindness. 1 million customers is a good-sized market, except that these were customers who could not afford the product. Knowing that the project would not produce a huge return on investment, if it produced one at all, the company nonetheless went forward with the hope that some government agencies or other third parties would purchase and distribute the product once available. No such luck. So Merck elected to give the drug away, free for all who needed it. Merck also involved itself directly in distribution efforts, at its own expense, to ensure that the drug did indeed reach the millions of people at risk from the disease. Asked why Merck made the Mectizan decision, Vagelis pointed out that failure to go forward with the product could have demoralized Merck scientists working for a company that explicitly viewed itself as in the business of preserving and improving human life. He also commented, "When I first went to Japan 15 years ago, I was told by Japanese business people that it was Merck that brought streptomycin to Japan after World War II. to eliminate tuberculosis, which was eating up their society. We did that. We didn't make any money. But it's no accident that Merck is the largest American pharmaceutical company in Japan today. The long-term consequences of such actions are not always clear, but somehow I think they always pay off. Did Merck's ideals, ideals that had consistently defined the company's self-identity since the late 1920s, drive the Mectizan decision? Or did Merck make the decision for pragmatic reasons, that is, good long-term business and good PR? Our answer? Both. Merck's ideals play a substantial role in the decision, and the evidence suggests that Merck could have gone ahead with the project regardless of whether it created long-term business benefits for the company. But the evidence also suggests that Merck acted on the assumption that such acts of goodwill somehow always pay off. This is a classic example of the genius of the and prevailing over the tyranny of the or. Merck has displayed throughout most of its history both high ideals and pragmatic self-interest. George Merck II explained this paradox in 1950. "I want to express the principles which we have in our company and we've endeavored to live up to. Here's how it sums up. We try to remember that medicine is for the patient. We try never to forget that medicine is for the people. It's not for the profits. The profits follow, and if we have remembered that, they have never failed to appear. The better we have remembered it, the larger they have been." Merck, in fact, epitomizes the ideological nature, the pragmatic idealism of highly visionary companies. Our research showed that a fundamental element in the ticking clock of a visionary company is a core ideology, core values and sense of purpose beyond just making money, that guides and inspires people throughout the organization and remains relatively fixed for long periods of time. Now you might be thinking, of course it's easy for a company like Merck to proclaim and pursue inspirational ideals. Merck makes drugs that do in fact save lives, cure disease, and relieve suffering. Good point, and we agree. But in contrast to its comparison company Pfizer, a company in the same industry, a company that also makes drugs that save lives, cure diseases, and relieve suffering, we found Merck to have been more ideologically driven than Pfizer during the developmental growth years of each company. Whereas George Merck II explicitly took a paradoxical view of profits, medicine is for the patient, the profits follow, John McKean, president of Pfizer during the same era as George Merck II, displayed a somewhat more lopsided perspective. "So far as is humanly possible," he said, "we aim to get profit out of everything we do." According to an article in Forbes, McKean believed that idle money was a sinfully non-productive asset. While Merck hoarded cash for investment in new research and drug development efforts, McKean launched a frenetic acquisition binge, purchasing 14 companies in 4 years and diversifying into such areas as farm products, women's toiletries, shaving products, and paint pigments. Why? To make more money, regardless of the line of business. "I would rather make 5% on $1 billion in sales than 10% on $300 million in ethical drugs," said McKean. We don't mean to quibble over strategies here, diversification via acquisition versus focus and innovation via R&D. But the evidence suggests that Pfizer during this era displayed more of a purely pragmatic profit orientation than Merck. Of course, a company like Merck could afford to have high ideals. As of 1925, when G.W. Merck II took over from his father, the company already had a track record of substantial business success and a sizable financial cushion. Might it be, therefore, that having high ideals is merely a luxury for companies such as Merck that are so successful that they can afford to proclaim an ideology? No. We found that high ideals, a core ideology, often existed in the visionary companies not just when they were successful, but also when they were struggling just to survive. Consider the following two examples: Sony at its founding and Ford during the 1983 turnaround crisis. When Masaru Ibuka started Sony among the ruins of a defeated and devastated 1945 Japan, he rented an abandoned telephone operator's room in the hollow remnants of a bombed and burned-out department store in downtown Tokyo, and with 7 employees and $1,600 of personal savings, began work. But what should be his first priorities? What should he do first among the depressing ruins? generate cash flow, figure out what business to be in, launch products, develop customers. Ibuka did indeed concentrate on these tasks. Recall from Chapter 2, the failed rice cooker, sweetened bean paste soup, and crude heating pads. But he also did something else, something remarkable for an entrepreneur wrestling with the problems of day-to-day survival. On May the 7th, 1946, less than 10 months after moving to Tokyo, and long before turning a positive cash flow, he created a prospectus for the company that included the following items. First, he wrote, "If it were possible to establish conditions where persons could become united with a firm spirit of teamwork and exercise to their heart's desire their technological capacity, then such an organization could bring untold pleasure and untold benefits." Purposes of incorporation: to establish a place of work where engineers can feel the joy of technological innovation, be aware of their mission to society, and work to their heart's content. To pursue dynamic activities in technology and production for the reconstruction of Japan and the elevation of the nation's culture. To apply advanced technology to the life of the general public. "We shall eliminate any unfair profit-seeking, persistently emphasize substantial and essential work, and not merely pursue growth. We shall welcome technical difficulties and focus on highly sophisticated technical products that have great usefulness in society, regardless of the quantity involved." Stop and think about this for a minute. How many entrepreneurial companies do you know that write such idealistic sentiments in their founding documents? How many corporate founders have you come across that think about such grand values and sense of purpose when simply struggling to bring in enough cash to keep the doors open? How many companies have you encountered that articulate a clear ideology at the start of the company, yet cannot articulate a clear idea of what products to make? As an aside, if you're at the early stages in the development of a company and have been putting off articulating a corporate ideology until you've attained business success, you might pause to consider the Sony example. In 1976, Nick Lyons observed in his book, The Sony Vision, that the ideals embodied in the prospectus have been a guiding force for the company these past 30 years, modified only slightly as Sony grew with extraordinary speed. In contrast to Sony stands Kenwood, Sony's comparison in the study. "We attempted to obtain directly from Kenwood any and all documents that would describe the company's philosophy, values, visions, and ideals. Kenwood responded that it had no such documents and sent merely a set of recent and fairly standard annual reports. We tried to obtain external writings on this subject, but found none." Perhaps Kenwood has had a consistent, pervasive ideology that, like Sony's, traces back to the moment of the company's conception, but we could find no evidence of it. Furthermore, we found substantial evidence of direct translations of Sony's ideology into tangible characteristics and practices, such as a highly individualistic culture and decentralized structure relative to other Japanese companies, and product development practices that explicitly eschew traditional market research. "Our plan is to lead the market with new products rather than ask them what kind of products they want. Instead of doing a lot of market research, we refine a product and try to create a market for it by educating and communicating with the public." And from these ideologically driven, tangible practices came a series of decisions to launch products for which there was no proven demand, including the first magnetic tape recorder in Japan in 1950, the first all-transistor radio in 1955, the first pocket-sized radio in 1957, the first home-use videotape recorder in 1964, and the Sony Walkman in 1979. Certainly, Sony wanted successful products. It didn't want to pioneer itself into bankruptcy. Nonetheless, the ideals of the Sony pioneer spirit traced their roots to the very early days of the company, long before it became a profitable venture, and have remained largely intact as a guiding force for nearly half a century. Yes, Sony made crude heating pads and sweetened bean paste soup to keep itself alive. That's pragmatism. But it always dreamed and pushed towards making pioneering contributions. That's idealism. Now, let's look at a company at the other end of the spectrum, an aging giant in a desperate turnaround crisis. In the early 1980s, Ford Motor Company found itself reeling, bleeding red ink from wounds inflicted during the repeated thrashings it took from Japanese competitors. Pause for a moment and put yourself in the shoes of the Ford senior management team. A management team atop a company suffering from a $3.3 billion net loss. That's 43% of its net worth in 3 years. What should they do? What should be their highest priorities? Naturally, the Ford team threw itself into a frenzy of emergency measures to stop the bleeding and keep the company breathing. But it also did something else, something unusual for a team facing such a tremendous crisis. It paused to clarify its guiding principles. According to Robert Shook, who researched and wrote a book on the 1980s Ford turnaround, the objective was to create a proclamation that clearly stated what the Ford Motor Company stood for. At times, the discussions sounded more like a college class in philosophy than a business meeting. Out of this process came Ford's mission, values, guiding principles, called its MVGP statement. Former Ford CEO Don Peterson commented, "There was a great deal of talk about the sequence of the three P's, people, products, and profits. It was decided that people should absolutely come first, products second, and profits third." If you're familiar with Ford's history, you may be skeptical of this ordering. Don't get us wrong here. We don't see Ford as exemplary throughout its entire history in labor relations and product quality. The bloody, brutal battles with laborers in the 1930s and the exploding Ford Pinto of the 1970s certainly leave Ford with a spotty record. Nonetheless, we found evidence that the Ford team's deliberations about the three P's reached back in time to reawaken an ideology espoused by Henry Ford in the early days of the company. The 1980s turnaround team wasn't inventing completely new ideals, but was, in part, breathing life back into the ones that had long lain dormant. In describing the relationship between the three P's in the early days of the company, Henry Ford commented in 1916, "I don't believe we should make such an awful profit on our cars. A reasonable profit is right, but not too much. I hold that it is better to sell a large number of cars at a reasonably small profit. I hold this because it enables a larger number of people to buy and enjoy the use of a car and because it gives a larger number of men employment at good wages. Those are the two aims I have in life." Idealistic prattle? Cynical pronouncements to pacify the public? Perhaps, but keep in mind that Ford transformed the American way of life for 15 million families with the affordable Model T, the people's car, in large part by reducing prices by 58% from 1908 to 1916. At the same time, Ford had more orders than it could fill and could have raised prices. Mr. Ford kept lowering them anyway, even in the face of a shareholder suit against the practice. And during the same era, he boldly introduced the $5 day for workers, which at roughly twice the standard industry rate, shocked and outraged the industrial world. As described by Robert Lacey in the book Ford, the Wall Street Journal accused Henry Ford of economic blunders, if not crimes, which would soon return to plague him and the industry he represents as well as organized society. In a naive wish for social improvement, declared the newspaper, Ford had injected spiritual principles into a field where they do not belong, a heinous crime, and captains of industry lined up to condemn the most foolish thing ever.